Part 1. The Pilot Town. Chapter 1. July 25, 1989. Cook Inlet, Alaska. Black clouds rolled menacingly over the sea from Kodiak Island and turned the deep blue-green surface to lead. The orange glow of the sun was snuffed out like a candle flame. Unlike most storms that swept in from the Gulf of Alaska, creating 50 or 100-mile-an-hour winds, this one bred a mild breeze. The rain began to fall, sparingly at first, then building to a deluge that beat the water white. On the bridge wing of the Coast Guard cutter Catawba, Lieutenant Commander Amos Dover peered through a pair of binoculars, eyes straining to penetrate the downpour. It was like staring into a shimmering stage curtain. Visibility died at 400 meters. The rain felt cold against his face, and colder yet as it trickled past the upturned collar of his foul-weather jacket and down his neck. Finally, he spat a waterlogged cigarette over the railing and stepped into the dry warmth of the wheelhouse. "Radar," he called out gruffly. "Contact 650 meters dead ahead and closing," the radar operator replied without lifting his eyes from the tiny images on the scope. Dover unbuttoned his jacket and wiped the moisture from his neck with a handkerchief. Trouble was the last thing he expected during moderate weather. Seldom did one of the fishing fleet or private pleasure craft go missing in midsummer. Winter was the season when the Gulf turned nasty and unforgiving. Chilled Arctic air meeting warmer air rising from the Alaska Current detonated incredible winds and towering seas that crushed hulls and iced deck structures until a boat grew top-heavy, rolled over, and sank like a brick. A distress call had been received by a vessel calling herself the Amy Marie. One quick SOS followed by a Loran position and the words, "Think all dying." Repeated calls requesting further information were sent out, but the radio on board the Amy Marie remained silent. An air search was out of the question until the weather cleared. Every ship within 100 miles changed course and steamed full speed in response to the emergency signals. Because of her greater speed, Dover reckoned the Catawba would be the first to reach the stricken vessel. Her big diesels had already pushed her past a coastal freighter and a halibut longliner Gulf boat, leaving them rocking in her wake. Dover was a great bear of a man who had paid his dues in sea rescue. He'd spent 12 years in northern waters, stubbornly throwing his shoulder against every sadistic whim the Arctic had thrown him. He was tough and wind-worn, slow and shambling in his physical movements, but he possessed a calculator-like mind that never failed to awe his crew. In less time than it had taken to program the ship's computers, he had figured the wind factor and current drift, arriving at a position where he knew the ship, wreckage, or any survivors should be found. And he'd hit it right on the nose. The hum of the engines below his feet seemed to take on a feverish pitch. Like an unleashed hound, the Catawba seemed to pick up the scent of her quarry. Anticipation gripped all hands. Ignoring the rain, they lined the decks and bridge wings. 400 meters, the radar operator sang out. Then a seaman clutching the bow staff began pointing vigorously into the rain. Dover leaned out the wheelhouse door and shouted through a bullhorn. "Is she afloat?" "Buoyant as a rubber duck in a bathtub," the seaman bellowed back through cupped hands. Dover nodded to the lieutenant on watch. "Slow engines." "Engines one-third," the watch lieutenant acknowledged as he moved a series of levers on the ship's automated console. The Amy Marie slowly emerged through the precipitation. They expected to find her half awash in a sinking condition. But she sat proud in the water, drifting in the light swells without a hint of distress. There was a silence about her that seemed unnatural, almost ghostly. Her decks were deserted, and Dover's hail over the bullhorn went unanswered. "A crabber by the look of her," Dover muttered to no one in particular. "Steel hull about 110 feet, probably out of a shipyard in New Orleans." The radio operator leaned out of the communications room and motioned to Dover. "From the Board of Register, sir, the Amy Marie's owner and skipper is Carl Keating, home port is Kodiak." Again Dover hailed the strangely quiet crab boat, this time addressing Keating by name. There was still no response. The Catawba slowly circled and hove to 100 meters away, then stopped her engines and drifted alongside. The steel cage crab pots were neatly stacked on the deserted deck, and a wisp of exhaust smoke puffed from the funnel, suggesting that her diesel engines were idling in neutral. No human movement could be detected through the ports or the windows of the wheelhouse. The boarding party consisted of two officers, Ensign Pat Murphy and Lieutenant Marty Lawrence. Without the usual small talk, they donned their exposure suits, which would protect them from the frigid waters if they accidentally fell into the sea. They had lost count of the times they had conducted routine examinations of foreign fishing vessels that strayed inside the Alaskan 200-mile fishing limit, yet there was nothing routine about this investigation. No flesh-and-blood crew lined the rails to greet them. They climbed into a small rubber Zodiac propelled by an outboard motor and cast off. Darkness was only a few hours away. The rain had eased to a drizzle, but the wind had increased, and the sea was rising. An eerie quiet gripped the Catawba. No one spoke. It was as though they were afraid to, at least until the spell produced by the unknown was broken. They watched as Murphy and Lawrence tied their tiny craft to the crab boat, hoisted themselves to the deck, and disappeared through a doorway into the main cabin. Several minutes dragged by. Occasionally, one of the searchers would appear on the deck, only to vanish again down a hatchway. The only sound in the Catawba's wheelhouse came from the static over the ship's open radiophone loudspeaker, turned up to high volume and tuned to an emergency frequency. Suddenly, with such unexpected abruptness that even Dover twitched in surprise, Murphy's voice loudly reverberated inside the wheelhouse. "Catawba, this is Amy Marie." "Go ahead, Amy Marie," Dover answered into a microphone. "They're all dead." The words were so cold, so terse, nobody absorbed them at first. "Repeat." "No sign of a pulse in any of them. Even the cat bought it." What the boarding party found was a ship of the dead. Skipper Keating's body rested on the deck, his head leaning against a bulkhead beneath the radio. Scattered throughout the boat in the galley, the mess room, and the sleeping quarters were the corpses of the Amy Marie's crew. Their facial expressions were frozen in twisted agony, and their limbs contorted in grotesque positions, as though they had violently thrashed away their final moments of life. Their skin had turned an odd black color, and they had gushed blood from every orifice. The ship's Siamese cat lay beside a thick wool blanket it had shredded in its death throes. Dover's face reflected puzzlement rather than shock at Murphy's description. "Can you determine a cause?" he asked. "Not even a good guess," Murphy came back. "No indication of struggle. No marks on the bodies, yet they bled like slaughtered pigs. Looks like whatever killed them struck everyone at the same time." "Stand by." Dover turned and surveyed the faces around him until he spotted the ship's surgeon, Lieutenant Commander Isaac Thayer. Doc Thayer was the most popular man aboard the ship. An old-timer in the Coast Guard service, he had long ago given up the plush offices and high income of shore medicine for the rigors of sea rescue. "What do you make of it, Doc?" Dover asked. Thayer shrugged and smiled. "Looks as though I better make a house call." Dover paced the bridge impatiently while Doc Thayer entered a second Zodiac and motored across the gap dividing the two vessels. Dover ordered the helmsman to position the Catawba to take the crab boat in tow. He was concentrating on the maneuver and didn't notice the radio operator standing at his elbow. "A signal just in, sir, from a bush pilot airlifting supplies to a team of scientists on Augustine Island." "Not now," Dover said brusquely. "It's urgent, Captain," the radio operator persisted. "Okay, read the guts of it." "Scientific party all dead. Then something unintelligible and what sounds like, save me." Dover stared at him blankly. "That's all?" "Yes, sir. I tried to raise him again, but there was no reply." Dover didn't have to study a chart to know Augustine was an uninhabited volcanic island only 30 miles northeast of his present position. A sudden, sickening realization coursed through his mind. He snatched the microphone and shouted into the mouthpiece. "Murphy, you there?" "Nothing." "Murphy! Lawrence, do you read me?" Again no answer. He looked through the bridge window and saw Doc Thayer climb over the rail of the Amy Marie. Dover could move fast for a man of his mountainous proportions. He snatched a bullhorn and ran outside. "Doc! Come back! Get off that boat!" his amplified voice boomed over the water. He was too late. Thayer had already ducked into a hatchway and was gone. The men on the bridge stared at their captain, incomprehension written in their eyes. His facial muscles tensed, and there was a look of desperation about him as he rushed back into the wheelhouse and clutched the microphone. "Doc, this is Dover. Can you hear me?" 2 minutes passed. 2 endless minutes while Dover tried to raise his men on the Amy Marie. Even the ear-splitting scream of the Catawba's siren failed to draw a response. At last, Thayer's voice came over the bridge with a strange icy calm. "I regret to report that Ensign Murphy and Lieutenant Lawrence are dead. I can find no life signs. Whatever the cause, it will strike me before I can escape. You must quarantine this boat. Do you understand, Amos?" Dover found it impossible to grasp that he was suddenly about to lose his old friend. "Do not understand, but will comply." "Good. I'll describe the symptoms as they come. Beginning to feel lightheaded already. Pulse increasing to 150. May have contracted the cause by skin absorption. Pulse 170. Thayer paused. His next words came haltingly. "Growing nausea. Legs. Can no longer. Support. Intense burning sensation. In sinus region. Internal organs feel like they're exploding." As one, everybody on the bridge of the Catawba leaned closer to the speaker, unable to comprehend that a man they all knew and respected was dying a short distance away. "Pulse. Over 200. Pain. Excruciating. Blackness closing vision." There was an audible moan. Tell my wife." The speaker went silent. You could smell the shock, see it in the widened eyes of the crew standing in stricken horror. Dover stared numbly at the tomb named the Amy Marie, his hands clenched in helplessness and despair. "What's happening?" he murmured tonelessly. "What in God's name is killing everyone?"